I'm Bae, and you're listening to Bae Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood in Baltimore. Shoot, I said I was going to stop saying that. Anyway, what should I say instead? A society and podcast. Well, I don't know. Anyway, I'll figure it out. Whatever. Oh, a pop culture and society podcast recorded in downtown Baltimore. That's what I'll say. Anyway, but it's quiet right now. Anyway, I watched the reality series, I guess. The reality doc. The show. I watched the show 28 Days Haunted. And the Netflix show, 28 Days Haunted, and I want to talk about it. But before I pop into that, I guess I want to... So this was... I'm a scaredy cat. I've said it. I'll keep saying it until the cows come home. This was scary to me, but at times I was a skeptic watching it. For so many different reasons, and I'll go into it. But it was an interesting watch for me. And I think I'll go into it because I think when I was watching the show, I was thinking of the ways in which different cultures, or at least the relationship that different cultures have with supernatural, with the supernatural. We know that Ireland and, Ireland definitely African traditional religions. Definitely, if you're looking at the Abrahamic religions, I'm not 100% sure about Judaism, but definitely in Christianity and Islam, there's definitely conversations about the supernatural. In, Islam, there is, I think everybody knows this by now, or maybe you don't know it, but it's becoming more widely understood that there is an entity called a jinn. And I know I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but jinn. And for all intents and purposes, a jinn is, from what I've been reading, I found this article from the, I'll have to pull it off the site. It's like the Royal Institute of something. Anyway, it was a long title. I'll cite it in the show notes. But I was reading this article where it was saying that the jinn or jinn, is an entity that not only is it something to be feared, but it's also something that's powerful and that should be feared, but it also has its own reality. It has its own world that exists. And I think that's a different approach of looking at the supernatural, because I think when Westerners think about the supernatural, at least, and again, when Westerners think about the supernatural, I think they think about it in relation to their existing world, the living world. Well, the existing world, because living can get complicated when you think about it that way. But from what I was reading in that study, it wasn't an article, it was a study. In the instance of the jinn, they have their own reality. And you get the sense that a person can be taken to that reality, but that the thing that makes them dangerous is the same thing that you could say about in folklore about Anansi, Papa Legbo, Anansi, I don't think Anansi is specifically, no, well, we know that Anansi is not, I think it's probably Anansi, is not specific to voodoo or hoodoo, the American practice, the Black American practice of hoodoo, but that it is a recognized entity in African traditional religious practices, or at least some of them, definitely voodoo. There are some, I don't know enough about Anansi, but Papa Legbo, there is, the realm that Papa Legbo inhabits is not quite what many would describe as hell, but it's not the best place in the world to inhabit. Anyway, but the point is, going back to the djinn, it's not that they're wholly bad, but they're definitely not to be trusted. I guess if you could simplify from the study that I was reading, you could say that they were something like a, well, you couldn't simplify them into just to say that they were tricksters, but that they're, if you had to grossly simplify it, I guess you could say that they're kind of like sirens. Or what has been characterized as something, well, not even a banshee. No, because banshee is more akin to a boo hag or a haint than a djinn. But anyway, a djinn has its own society. It has its own realm. But that it's largely, when in this realm, it's a tempter. And because you understand that for many cultures, religion is the way, well, not even many cultures, religion, if you think about the purpose of religion, the purpose of religion is to give meaning in many ways to life's answers. That's, in a nutshell, what the function of religion. Now, the answers might not be satisfying to a person who doesn't choose to practice that faith, or even someone who's spiritual, but nevertheless, that is a function of spirituality. And so, if you look at it from that guise, if I'm understanding it correctly, and again, I'm just really looking into this particular study, and then things here and there that I've read, or interviews that I've heard, the djinn are seductors and are pretty powerful, but are also, they're pretty powerful. They're not all bad. They're definitely not good, but they're not all bad, but they are tempters. If you're looking at it from maybe not necessarily orthodox, but that's the only word that can come to mind at the moment, but looking at it from an orthodox perspective, you definitely need to not play with them. But again, that's the approach, that's the religious approach to every entity that is named or is acknowledged in spiritual practice that acknowledges otherworldly entities, because not all of them do. But just thinking about the Abrahamic, without question, Christianity and Islam absolutely do. And again, the jinn is one of the entities, the otherworldly entities, the supernatural entities that is acknowledged. But the thing about it is, you and I have heard about jinn. If you're in my age group, you heard about jinn as a child, but you didn't understand it. You didn't understand what you were hearing. It was very friendly and watered down. It was a very, we were introduced to a very friendly and watered down version of what a jinn is. And if you've already Googled it by now, or even if what I've said has tipped you off, maybe you heard this before, but a jinn is a genie. And we were both, if you're in my age group, actually, even if you're not in my age group, you were exposed to this. If you grew up as a child of the 50s and 60s, definitely, maybe, well, I don't know when the show came out, but definitely in the 60s, you were exposed to the jinn, but a very watered down version. And how you were exposed was through American media, American entertainment. In the 60s, you were exposed through I Dream of Jeannie. And in the 90s, you were exposed through Aladdin, which, by the way, I'm learning Aladdin is not how you pronounce it. It's probably more closely pronounced like Aladdin. And it's two different words, not one word, but like two. But you know how when you take a word from one language to English, how we kind of mess it up sometimes anyway and mash it up. But anyway, so yeah, I Dream of Jeannie and Aladdin. And literally in Aladdin, we were so, unless I'm remembering or misremembering the movie, and even the Will Smith live action version of it, we didn't even give the genie a name, which is wild. But anyway, but yeah, so what did I want to say? So we've been exposed to other cultures, specifically Islam's, an aspect of the supernatural represented in Islam as children for decades, but we weren't. I just stepped on. You ever stepped on the cords, like the not just the cord, but the end that goes into the wall, where the, with the metal prongs hanging out. Yeah, I just stepped on that and it hurt my feelings. Anyway, not only did it hurt my foot, but it hurt my feelings because I almost fell into the wall. Anyway, but yeah, so we've been exposed to that as a child, but we never understood what we were looking at. Some of you remember, I think, a more accurate representation, or at least one that's closer to what is understood in Islam and certainly what is identified in this study, which is, again, not all-encompassing. Well, I didn't say this, but it's not all-encompassing. It's a study. If you are a practitioner of Islam, I imagine it also depends on, I know you probably don't use this in Islam, but it's the only way I can describe it, but it depends on the denomination of Islam that you practice. And I know that's not what the phrase is. I know there's Sunni and Shia and there are multiple parts of there are different ways of practicing Islam, just like there are different ways of practicing Christianity. Anyway, and so not every one of them acknowledges, I would imagine not every one of them acknowledges the jinn, but maybe they do. Maybe they do, but I just don't know enough because I'm ignorant and I just don't know enough. But anyway, but I guess the one that is closer to what probably most people in the Islamic or the Muslim faith community would probably resonate with is the portrayal of the jinn in American Gods that came out, the Neil Gaiman book from the 90s, and the television adaptation from Stars. When was that? When did that come out? Was that 2014, 2015? It's probably a little earlier than that, but or a little later than that, but more like 17, 18, probably. Anyway, but yeah, the explanation, or at least the portrayal of that entity in that show was a little bit closer to an actual jinn. Again, not a thing that grants wishes, but definitely something that is not all good, and it's actually not all bad, but it's definitely an entity with its own mind that has its own realm. And again, it goes back to my thought while I was watching 28 Days Haunted. I couldn't help but think that different cultures have different relationships with the supernatural. And so even in Christianity, not all denominations of Christianity think about the supernatural in the same way. Certainly, the way that the Roman Catholic Church, or Catholic, I don't even, if that's the, is that the proper term? Roman Catholic. Anyway, even the Catholic Church has a very set, like everybody is aware that they have whole teams of folks whose job it is to investigate and free individuals of demonic possessions. Demonic possessions is, and if you're not thinking about it, it is part of the supernatural. Supernatural demons and the supernatural are referenced several times in the Old Testament. I believe it's also referenced a few times in the New, but it's definitely referenced several times. Actually, in the Old and the New, it is referenced several times in both the Old Testament and the New. But Catholicism is maybe not the only. Catholicism, though, has an organized department, teams of individuals who investigate what is, authenticate, more than that, they authenticate what is true and what is not true. And so, in terms of demonic possession, in the faith that I subscribe to, or at least the practice that I subscribe to, which is Black Church, because the Black Church, the Black Christian Church, I gotta say that, has so many remnants of hoodoo in it and other African religious traditional practices in them. But from my perspective, it's definitely the hoodoo's influence. It's just a general conversation. I think we always talk about demonic possession and the supernatural in that context. Or at least I, as a child, I don't ever remember a time where there wasn't a mention of the supernatural. It's not like we were talking about it every day or every time we were in fellowship with one another, but it was definitely something that was continuously talked about. And so I have a different relationship with the supernatural than someone who was not raised in the Black Church or even in Christianity. Or, well, but again, thinking about the Abrahamic religions, folks that grew up hearing about the supernatural have a different relationship with it. I can't prove it, but I would venture to guess that a lot of these ghost hunters that come on TV, I know that there are whole TV shows devoted to ghost hunting, probably did not grow up in a faith tradition, Christian or not, but probably did not grow up with a faith tradition that spent a lot of time talking about the supernatural. Or if they did, they're in the business of ghost hunting for a different reason. They're saying, excuse me, my voice is going. They're saying, I don't know. I would just, it would be interesting to know truly what their background is, what's driving them to search for these answers in this way. Because again, in this, if you follow a spiritual practice that acknowledges the supernatural, you just have a different relationship with it. Some of these questions aren't really questions. It's more about acknowledging and identifying than it is about debunking, which these shows tend to do. And so what I thought was, this series scared me. And again, at times I was not sure if it was staged. I was always vacillating between, oh, y'all doing the most, you're playing it up for the cameras, and vacillating between them playing it up for the cameras and then thinking, ooh, suspending my disbelief and saying, ooh, but what if? And then getting stuck into the story. And I don't think I've finally landed on, I don't think I've landed on an answer. But this, it was interesting enough for me to continue watching. And what was interesting to me is there is, there were three teams, and I'll go into this later, but one of the teams had either one person or both people who were religious and practiced a denomination that I, just a different denomination than mine, but nevertheless, were religious. And that one was one of the most interesting because of their approach to it. But again, I vacillated. I think the whole series, I vacillated back and forth between saying y'all doing too much to vacillating between y'all doing too much to, well, wait a minute, what if? And I think that's what keeps people watching the shows, regardless of your relationship to the supernatural. What keeps you watching these shows is that we as humans are inquisitive. And despite the fact, like in the instance of a jinn, despite the fact that, you know, probably Muslim faith children or kids that grew up in Islam, practicing Islam, or at least in cultures that were immersed in the faith, probably learned all the ways to not engage with them. Like the like haints, not just like many in my culture were taught, especially in the Carolinas and in the South, taught not to engage a haint, which is another form of a demonic possession in a way. There's different ways of thinking about how a haint becomes a haint, but nevertheless, it's so ingrained in Southern religious, or just actually it's secular now, because there's literally a paint color. Sherman Williams has a paint color called haint blue. Everybody, I would think that this would be something that's widely known, but if you Google it right now, haint is, how do you spell haint? There's different ways that you spell haint, but it's H-A-I-N-G-H-T, haint. Maybe, I don't know. I think if you get close, it feels, some people say call it haunt blue, because haint is a way of saying haunt. That's how I was taught. That's how I was taught that haint is a version of saying, a way of saying haunt. And I think it's a Gullah Geechee way of saying haunt, which Gullah Geechee has its own dialect. And it's funny that if you listen to someone who's from Guyana and then you listen, or maybe even Trinidad, and you listen to, like, born and bred, born and raised, has the accent of a Trinidadian or a Guyanian, it sounds similar. The accents were similarly influenced in a lot of ways. But haint blue is a color, and it's a color that you typically put in the ceiling of your porch. A porch is a very Southern concept. Most Northern homes, especially on the East Coast, have stoops. If they have anything at all. But a porch is a Southern concept. But of course, we have porches up here in Baltimore. Most people have porches all the way up the East Coast, up and down the East Coast now. But specifically in the South, especially in the region that I'm talking about, the Gullah Geechee region, you put that blue on your porch. And there are other ways that you can incorporate that shade of blue or those shades of blue. And if you go back and listen to my episode, African-American Folk Tales, from probably 4 years ago, three or four years ago, it was in reference to, I'll never forget, it was in reference to Michael B. Jordan saying that black folks don't have folklore of our own, so he was going to make folklore. A very ignorant statement, just totally bereft of any real information, and it almost as if he wasn't even talking to any of the people who were a teench older than him. To know better. But anyway, we often speak before we really know sometimes, and it's something we all have to grow out of. But anyway, or just to be educated on. But anyway, it was in response to that, and so I did a series, I think, was it all that October? Can't remember the year, but if you go back and look, the series will pop up, and I talk about African-American folklore. And one of the tales that I tell is a story that's pretty much retold a ton of times, and it's about the boo hag. A boo hag is like a haint. Somebody's probably going to correct me, but from my perspective, a boo hag is very much like a haint in that it's a tortured, it was someone that was once living that is now tortured and is something like a demon. And needs to be shooed off. Yeah, it needs something that needs to be warded off. But in the spiritual practice, and well, in acknowledging that aspect of my culture, one of the things is the boo hag, not only does it need to be warded off, but you got to be careful not to invite it in. And I think that's true of the djinn. You got to be careful not to invite the djinn in, because when you invite them in, they can cause all manner of havoc. Now, I don't know if there's a particular way to ward off a djinn or not. I think from what I was reading and from the documentaries that, or at least the conversations that I've heard, the djinn live kind of on the outskirts of those of physical communities. Like, so they're in a place, and if you steer clear. Maybe children were taught from a young child that you steer clear of these places in the village or in the community. You steer clear of these places on the outskirts because that's where the djinn hang out. And if you go in there, you just invite in trouble. Because again, you're not smarter than the djinn, and they can mess with you. And so anyway, the haint and the djinn are not referenced in any manner in this series. In fact, the series is very, all the investigators present as white. And so you get the sense that those cultures just aren't anything that they've probably been exposed to. But the religious aspect was the thing that kind of got me started on this. That investigator team that was had the religious aspect of it that was kind of started me thinking about all of these things. And anyway, so in the next segment, I'm going to talk about the three teams, the three cases, and generally talk about why they're there in the first place. Because I'll just go ahead and give you the biggest piece. They're there to test a theory. And it's an interesting theory. Another one that we've been exposed to. But anyway, talk about the particulars of the series, the theory itself, who created the theory, and more in the next segment. So stay tuned. Okay, so before I get into 28 Days Haunted, the question that I want to ask is, in the Jewish faith, I know there are different, again, this is not the term that is used, but there are different denominations or ways of practicing Judaism. I think a lot of people have heard about, I don't even know if Kabbalah or the Kabbalah is like a watered down version of Judaism or not. I don't know enough about the Abrahamic religion to then compare it to the Kabbalah. But anyway, I know that there are different denominations of, I don't even know if they're recognized. Anyway, I know there are different ways of practicing Judaism. But what I don't know is the Abrahamic religion's connection to the supernatural. I know that there's a different, I don't think the concept of the afterlife, I don't know. I just don't know. So I guess I would, the question is, in Judaism, is the afterlife a concept that is accepted? And if so, generally speaking, what is a practitioner's relationship or the faith's relationship to the supernatural? Because that's not something I've ever heard of before. Not that I know like a lot of stuff about Judaism. I've learned through my spiritual journey. I have been interested in religious practice since I was in college, so I've been learning about religions that are different than the one that I practice, and even different denominations of Christianity, because being a Christian myself, I really don't know much about Catholicism. Not much. I'm learning, but I don't know much. I'm learning about Islam and the different ways that folks practice it. I know that all the Abrahamic religions have orthodox groups within the religion that feel very strongly that the way that they practice is the unadulterated, pure way, the right, the correct way. I think all religions have that. It's just that the Abrahamic religions tend to be, they're more, zealotry is a part of, is a factor for sure. In those religions because of the premise, or at least anyway, whole nother conversation. Don't want to go into it, but the question is, I'm good. Definitely. I think I shared that. I'm pretty sure I shared that. I'm a part of a cohort of religious folks who practice. Well, they don't have to practice the Abrahamic religions. I think you can actually be a part of this. And, as long as you're working in the faith community or your work touches the faith community in a significant way, I think you can be a part of this cohort. But by and large, most of the people in the cohort practice one of the Abrahamic religions. And anyway, we're broken down into groups in group projects. And I think the group that I've been broken up into now is the group that I'm going to be in for the duration of the fellowship. And I think they intentionally had someone who represented the Christian faith, someone who represented who represented all three in the faith. So there's a Muslim faith woman who I actually spent some time getting to know. And then a woman who practices the Jewish faith that we began to have a conversation in this fellowship, but we haven't. We're going to go deeper and just to learn from each other. The religion is the basis for our work, but it is not the entirety of our work. It's just the thing that provides the base. and so I'm going to ask her. I'm going to ask the question of her, but I want to ask the question of here, because I know that if you ask one person, you just ask one person about a thing. So I will form that question in the show notes a little bit, put it out in a question to the community, because I'm genuinely curious. And not that I need the right answer, but I would like to be put in the space where I could learn more. Because that's just, I eat that stuff up because, again, my belief is that we're all spiritual beings, whether you recognize it or not. Whether you recognize the part that spirituality plays in your life or not, I think we are all inherently spiritual beings. And so it's just interesting to me and enlightening to me the ways in which we all practice faith differently. Because even though many in my faith believe that that's the one true way, we can never be sure. That's the whole point of faith. And so to see people practice their faith, oh, and I'm going out on a tangent. Anyway, to see people practice their faith in different ways as a means to kind of be a compass in their life and kind of guide their life is something that everybody should pay attention to. That's my question, but let me move on. So here's what you need to know. So this documentary was released. I keep saying it's a documentary. It's not a documentary. For all intents and purposes, it's a reality show. So this reality show, 28 Days Haunted, was released I think it was 3 days ago. Hold on. Because this show is a little bit different. It's not reviewed in the same way that some of the movies and TV series have been reviewed. This thing was released. Girl, are you going to tell me when it was released? Oh, the 21st. No, that's not the month. I guess. October 21st was when the whole series was dropped. So last week, last Friday, by the time this show is coming out, it was last Friday. All right. So, this is good because I wasn't sure how to talk about these teams, but I have a way of doing it now. Okay. So, the show features paranormal investigators reviewing cases or doing their work in three different parts of the United States. Colorado, Connecticut, and North Carolina. The places where they are, I think the only town that I remember with certainty is that I think they were in Denver when they were in Colorado, that particular team. But they are in these particular communities. And I think it's worth noting that Connecticut and North Carolina, and in the age order, obviously Connecticut is one of the oldest states in the union. Then it goes North Carolina, another old state, but not as old as Connecticut. And then it goes Denver, which is the newer, the youngest of the three, which in my mind would have some significance because there's just way more North Carolina, even though it's a southern state, still way more densely populated in many instances at different times than Colorado. Even Denver, that is densely populated now, but it wasn't always true. Because again, it's just a younger in comparison. So I would imagine when I was watching this, one of the things that struck me was that, you know, there's just deeper history. So there are more lives that could have been impacted. There's more story perhaps in Connecticut and North Carolina than there maybe is in Denver, but what do I know? It's just something that came across for me. But there are three teams. And so there are three teams, and I guess I'm just gonna, how do I wanna do this? So there's a team that included Sean Austin, Aaron G. Thompson, and Amy Parks. Amy Parks and I think Shane Pittman. That team of four was in Connecticut. No, they were in Denver. That team of four was in Denver. Jerome Leonard and Brandy Miller were in South Carolina. And then Nick Simons, Ray Causey, hmm. Oh, no, no, no. So let me, so, oh, shucks. I messed up. All right. So I'm going to give you these people, but like when you watch it, it'll make more sense. So let me just go in the smaller team. So Jerome Leonard and Brandy Miller were in North Carolina in a essentially a shop that was in North Carolina, I believe. That was also the site of someone's home, a family's home prior to, and some a gruesome discovery in the 1800s. Let me just go. Ray Causey, Nick Simons, Amy Parks were the team that was in Connecticut. And then Shane Pittman, Aaron Sagers, Aaron G. Thompson, and Sean Austin were the team that was in Denver. Okay. So there was like a team of, wait, 1, 2, 3, 4. A team of 4 in Colorado, a team of 2 in North Carolina, and a team of 3. Wait, hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, and a team of 3 in Connecticut. And paranormal investigators is like a loose understanding of what they are. Instead, not all of them were paranormal investigators. Some of them were. One of them was like the two women. Amy Parks was like a sensitive someone who recognized that they had abilities to communicate with the supernatural. Brandy Miller, who identified as a medium, and everyone else, with the exception of Aaron Sagers, was just a researcher, paranormal researcher. Aaron Sagers, throughout the show, understands that they are a sensitive person too, might even have medium abilities. And again, there are aspects of this that you just need to, you have to go into this. Well, I guess you don't have to go into this any old type of way, but there are certain things that this show is asking you to believe. It's asking you to believe these people are who they say they are, whether or not you believe they have a gift or an ability, they're saying that they do. And so this show is asking you to listen to them and watch what they experience. Now, why are we even here at the three teams? What makes them so special? Why is this 28 Days Haunted? So 28 Days Haunted, in a nutshell, and by the way, on IMDb, for whatever it's worth, this show has 3.4 out of 10 stars, which means that by and large, it's not a great. And I would venture to say that if Rotten Tomatoes ever reviewed it, it would probably be a little bit higher, but it would probably be 50%. It would not be more than that. Largely because, again, the show is asking you to believe these individuals and believe their experiences. But unfortunately, we've watched a lot of movies and TV shows that have scared us so much that we're jaded these days. And unless you have not watched these movies, which would be hard to do because the show is really intended for an late teenage, early adult, and older audience, right? So that whole swath of generations that I just included have already seen the scariest of the scary. Even the oldest of the generations watched The Exorcist. Or not Nosferatu. Well, maybe not Nosferatu. I'm doing a lot right there. But have watched some scary stuff over their lifetime. They can remember being a teenager or a 20-something, depending on your age, and The Exorcist coming out and people being physically sick in the theaters. So to see these things, and it was one of the reasons why they were physically sick, is because number one, nothing like that had been seen on screen like that before. Two, at least the audiences that were watching it, and two, it was advertised as being based on a true story. If you go back and watch The Exorcist, the opening credits say that this is based on a true story, which there's a whole podcast that says that talks about the fact that, yeah, The Exorcist is based on a story in Boston.
Those stairs are Boston. Those stairs are Boston.
The movie was set in Boston. I think the story was based in St. Louis. There's a St. Louis connection that I can't quite put my finger on, but if you go listen to the podcast about it, I think it's, what's it called? Just Google The Exorcist. There's a podcast that comes up. I imagine if I think about it, I'll put it in the show notes so that you can go directly to it, because it's an interesting listen. I'm a scaredy cat, so it was scary to me. It was chilling to me, but maybe it won't be chilling for you. Anyhow. But I can imagine the reason why it's 3.4 is because folks were probably looking for something a bit more. But if you ever watched the discoveries or the ghost shows or the ghost hunting shows on Discovery or AMC, this is like them. In many ways, this is like them. Again, they're asking you, they're pleading with you, viewer, please dispel your belief, or at the very least, believe that these people believe that they are paranormal researchers and they have a lot of evidence and lots of years of evidence collected, or lots of evidence collected over the years of investigations, and that these people who are saying they're either mediums or sensitives, they are who they say they are. Regardless of whether or not you believe that it's real, they believe it. And so it's asking you to dispel that. But I think I mentioned this in the intro, but there are times when it just feels the duo in South Carolina or North Carolina give me pause, because that was the group that was spiritual. And one person went in there and said, as part of his practice, that he uses his faith as a way to combat evil presences. And it just sounds naive, because anyone of any faith recognizes that when you put yourself in the center, you've already messed up. And so I think the reason why I was drawn to see the rest of the, actually, that's exactly why I was drawn to watch the rest of the series, largely because in the Denver case, there were some interesting clues that were being dropped. And again, probably a reason why they said it was 3.5, because it feels, if you're a skeptic, or if you're not easily swayed, some of this can seem coincidental, but again, you're being asked to dispel your belief. But the North Carolina crew, that one is the one that kept me watching, only because the guy who was using his faith to combat the negative presence, the evil that they believed to be inhabiting that location. And again, I think the show immediately goes off the premise that anything that's haunted is demonic. It's not, it's torturous, or it's a tortured soul or an entity that is evil and has bad intent. That's the premise. And I think actually that's the premise of most of these shows, which again, I say, depending on your religious practice or the culture that you were brought up in or both, your relationship with the supernatural doesn't always mean that the entities that you engage with are inherently evil. But this is the premise of, from what I can tell, of a lot of the shows, the ghost hunting shows, and it's kind of the premise of this one too. But anyway, so it's just the arrogance of that individual thinking that they alone can
do what needs to be done to banish this evil presence is just shocking, the arrogance in that statement. Because again, if you're of a religious practice that believes that, you are not an island unto yourself. You need help. Anyway, I'm about to go down a rabbit hole, and maybe I'll finish that line of thought, but the arrogance was a lot. But anyway, let me tell you why we're here. So the premise of the show, the reason why it's 28 days and not just a night, like a lot of these shows are, like a night or a weekend. You've seen it on TV. Even Ghost Hunters International, they would go to penitentiaries, unused penitentiaries across the globe, and stay for a weekend and then be out. But the premise of this show is that these teams stay for 28 days to do their investigation. And the rationale is pretty straightforward. So let me just read this, though. Three teams spend 28 days in some of the most haunted locations in the United States for an experiment based on the theories of paranormal investigators Ed and Lorraine Warren. So they're conducting research. Again, I told you that these folks most of them identified as researchers. Two of them identify as mediums. Two of them identify either as a medium or someone who is sensitive to the paranormal. But they're all there in these three different locations to test a theory. They're going to places that have had multiple reportings of paranormal activity. And so that's what they're meaning by most haunted, because they probably have multiple cases of folks reporting these experiences. And so they chose these locations because of the stories and because of the reports. And so they're going to investigate it. But you and I both know that it's not good for TV for you to go to a place that you can't prove that something is happening. It makes for boring TV, right? So I think we all kind of go in, even though the show wants us to take this seriously, I think we go in saying, you better show me the goods. You better show me some excitement, or I'm not going to keep watching. So both of those things are kind of at play when you're watching this. But let me tell you about Ed and Lorraine Warren. You've heard of Ed and Lorraine Warren. And now go with me here. Some of you probably instantly recognize their names. Maybe their names have been used in some of the movies and television that I'm about to talk about. But because I'm a scaredy cat, and because a lot of these stories are a little too close, to home, in terms of spiritual practices, a little too close to, acknowledging the spiritual—it's a little too close to home, because in terms of how I practice my faith and my cultural beliefs, I don't watch that stuff. I don't watch a lot of it. I do watch some of it, as evidenced by Insidious, which messed me up for a good long time. And I've talked about that. I feel like I've talked about it every Halloween since I watched it, because I watched it on Halloween night, which was the worst idea in the whole wide world. And then I went home. Yikes. Anyway. So I watched it over a friend's house, and then I went home. Anyway. But Ed and Lorraine Warren were paranormal investigators in real life, and there were movies based on them. I think in the Insidious franchise, the Paranormal Activity franchise, the Annabelle franchise, all of those movies either referenced the Warrens or had characters that were literally supposed to be the Warrens, all of them. And there are probably some in that universe that I'm forgetting, but these people exist in some of these scary movie franchises where haunting is the basis. And so they had a theory, and I think this theory is explained in some of these movies even, that in order to truly understand if a situation is haunted or a place is haunted, an investigator will need to spend 28 days there to determine if it's true. And in those 28 days, not only are they they're there to experience the happenings at that location that is proposed to be or purported to be haunted, but they're literally working to try to debunk anything. Like if somebody's playing a trick, like in 28 days, these seasoned professionals will be able to suss out the trick. That's how it's presented. That's not necessarily how it is as a viewer. That's not how we feel it in the show. In the show, it's a foregone conclusion, and I guess they're just trying to find more evidence. That's kind of how it's presented in the show. But the theory is, well, it takes 28 days for us to really understand what the heck this thing is, if it is what we think it is, and then to figure out the next steps. I think in this show, the next steps are described to be to get rid of it. Because again, the premise is, the angle that they're coming from is that it's inherently a bad thing. Because these are inherently evil. And again, I've shared that in a lot of spiritual practices, that's not always the case. It's not always black and white like that. And the last person that I want to mention in the cast is Tony Spera. Tony Spera is the grandson of Ed and Lorraine Warren, who I don't think I understood this. Or at the very least, I might have missed it. It's possible that I missed it. But I don't know if he's actively an investigator. Maybe he was at a long... Maybe. But anyway, he was definitely on the show as consulted with throughout the series as we were learning, as the investigators were going along in their conducting their business. And so, yeah, and he's looked upon as the authority here. And so, yeah, so the 3.5 from IMDb is probably close to being accurate. I would say that. That 40% or 50%, like 45% or 50% is probably more accurate if you were to review it on IMDb. Anyway, so how many episodes are in this? Because I think I might have missed it. And I hope this doesn't bump up anything. Okay, it's one season that has, hold on. Let me just go through. It's one season with 6 episodes. All right. One season with 6 episodes. So you get the sense. Y'all ever remember reading those Haunted America books? I had them. I had like one of them, or at least I checked it out from the library when I was a teenager. But it's several stories across different major cities. Or Heartland Haunted. I think I read that one. There are multiple across the United States. And I know that these types of books exist in other communities, or not communities, in other countries. But nevertheless, because I think the paranormal is ultimately something that is globally interesting. It's just the approach is different depending on your culture and the religious practices. But anyway, here's my point. There's absolutely going to be a season 2, depending on how this was received, because there are multiple stories. Again, this only followed 3 for 28 days. And it's probably supposed to be a vehicle for telling more of those stories. It's just the problem is with being first, you got to get it really right. And I don't know that this series gets it really right. But anyway, so let me just spend a second talking about the 3 different cases. So in a nutshell, the reason why we were in Connecticut, in North Carolina, and Denver is because some horrific stuff happened in those places. In Denver, am I running ahead? All right, so what we know is that someone met an untimely death in all of those, in every one of those spaces. In North Carolina and Connecticut, there's a family. Families are involved. In Denver, friends were involved. And again, remember what I said in the beginning, I guess, of this segment, is that one of the things that you have to recognize is the United States grew from the colonies in the Northeast, for the most part, Virginia and was it North Carolina at the time? Definitely Virginia. Yeah, I think North Carolina was a part of it. But for the most part, the Northeast, although you wouldn't consider the Carolinas to be the North. There's lots of arguments even today whether or not Maryland is the North. Definitely Virginia is considered the South. Anything south of Virginia is also South. But folks in Maryland do not necessarily consider themselves to be Southerners, even though Maryland is below the Mason-Dixon line. Anyhow, but you have the colonies who were populated first. And even in order, some of the locations were populated sooner than others, or earlier than others. But anyway, my point is there's a whole lot of history in the Northeast specifically. So Connecticut, for sure, the amount of stories, the amount of lives that were lived there and finished there are way more in number than in Denver. Largely because even though you recognize there were people who were here before the pilgrims came here. Actually, let me take that back because I think I started on a fallacy that I'm going to correct even now. I'm looking at this from a very European perspective, and I need to stop doing that. The show certainly does not say that, but it's kind of from a very white, Eurocentric perspective. But the reality of it is, especially in Colorado, there were whole communities of people who were living in and around Colorado, and I think they're actually in Denver for this story. And so there were lots of lives that were lived that were begun and ended in the area. But I guess I would just wonder what the populations were. Was it an explosion of a population and then it was completely decimated by the European invaders that ultimately became U.S. citizens? Is that a situation there? I'm sure that there's an aspect of it there, but we don't have the numbers, or at least I don't know where to get those numbers. And it seems to me that some of those numbers would even be estimates, but I do apologize for coming from it from a colonizer perspective, saying that nothing was there until white people got there. We know that that's not true. I guess the thing that I'm leaning on is the fact that these places, Connecticut specifically, when you're thinking of the Northeast, were densely populated because of immigration. I guess that's what I'm really trying to say. But I can say that without disrespecting whole communities of people, of indigenous Americans who were here, whose people were here long, 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 long before Columbus and the pilgrims. So anyway, so it's not to say that Denver has less history or Colorado has less history. It's just, I'm wondering if it was as densely populated as Connecticut, which in my mind would mean that there are a lot of lives that were begun and ended in these spaces. And it would just seem to me that, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I guess I would think that there would be a lot more activity. That's what I really want to say. I imagine there would be a lot more activity there. Then again, lots of battles were fought in the West. And lots of battles, lots of fighting in the West. But again, it's hard to figure out what those numbers are, except to deal with the estimates. So anyway, but I'll move on. Let me see if I can make this clean, because I'm going to be honest with you. The Connecticut story, I think I'm forgetting, because the Denver and the North Carolina story were pretty doggone compelling. For different reasons. So let me just cut to the quick. So what we know is that in Denver, two friends' lives were taken. They were in their late teens or early 20s, and their lives were taken. And so the idea is that the team of four that's there is experiencing these tortured souls. In North Carolina, a family's life was ended. And there's a salacious story there's a salacious theory as to why that incident occurred. In Connecticut, it's another situation of a person being lost to violence and as a result causing havoc, or at least making people uncomfortable in the place. It's just, I don't remember the conclusion of that, largely because it just wasn't, I think the most compelling part of the story was the fighting within the team. So you'll have to watch it to learn what happened in the Connecticut story, because the Connecticut story is interesting. It's just the more interesting part of it was the ways in which the team was fighting and being pushed, I think. Let me just live there. So that was a team of three, and it was two guys and a woman, and this one had the woman who was sensitive. So not a medium, but like someone who was sensitive, who whose connection to the paranormal in this context was stronger than the average person's. That's what the show wants us to believe. And so there were portions there were moments in the investigation. Again, this was over the span of 28 days. There were portions in the investigation. They were in a house where am I tripping? No, I'm not tripping. There were moments where she was needed to kind of not necessarily provoke the entity that was in the home, but definitely to engage with it. And there were moments where she became extremely uncomfortable, and the team was relying on her were putting all their eggs in her basket, because for a number of different reasons, I guess I don't 100% understand why they were leaning on her to do a lot of the heavy lifting when they were all a team. But she was pushed to her limit many different times, two very specific times, one of which she wanted to walk away completely and change the way that the nature of the investigation. And then there was another time where she compromised, and then she went in again and was made uncomfortable instantly. And so one of the researchers tapped into their own senses, basically, and discovered that they too could help communicate with restless entities. And I think here is a reason why folks kind of panned the show, because there was a lot of drama. I think there's natural drama when you have, when you put a group of people who are supposed to work together in an environment where it's not super friendly and there's some unexplained things that are happening that it's your job to investigate, that the stress levels could become high. You're away from your family. These folks were literally away from their family for 28 days. So the stress of being away from home hangs heavy on you. The stress of not having definitive answers perhaps weighs on you. And the idea that you have to stick it out to 28 days to test this theory that isn't yours probably weighs on you as well. And so that just back and forth battle was something that was compelling of that story. But then it kind of took a turn when one of the investigators began to tap into his own paranormal. And again, the show is wanting you to dispel, is wanting you to just trust that these folks are being careful with your trust. And there was just moments where I just felt scripted. And if it wasn't scripted, definitely played up for drama. We go to Carolina, and this is the story of, it's like a hardware shop that used to be the site of a home where a family died in a very tragic way. What we come to know is everybody, including the women and children, were killed in this situation, but we don't know the why. How we get there is that the father had something to do with it. But the why the father had something to do with it is the thing that makes it kind of turns your stomach. If this is true, it turns your stomach. But I think the thing that kind of kills the story, or at least makes the story less effective, is the instance where this is the duo where the guy is using his faith to confront demons and negative energy and entities. And it just seems like a mockery of reality. There's a moment where it feels like, well, it's acknowledged that this investigator is being influenced by the negative energy that was in the home, that was perhaps presumed to be in the home, the point at which the family met their untimely ends. And that spirit that allegedly drove the father to do those things was on the investigator. And again, it just felt, there's a moment where there's a medical emergency. And again, the show wants you to believe that these folks are not fooling you. But at the same time, it just feels like a lot. It feels in 28 days and in this medium, it just feels like done for shock. Again, because we have the Paranormal Activity movies of the world, the Insidious movies of the world, and all the super scary films that you could think of that frightened you as a child, if you're older, the things that, and you've never seen like Paranormal Activity or any of the other shows I'm talking about, there were plenty of scary, Poltergeist, very scary. I came out in the 80s, very scary. And other scary films that came out for your generation, like we've seen them all. We've seen them all. Some people are a scary movie buff, so they've genuinely seen them all. But every generation by now has seen a lot of scary stuff related to hauntings. And so when you watch it on TV, when you watch it in a series, it just seems like a farce. And it seems put on. And certainly in this North Carolina case, this is the premise of The Exorcist, right? That a person is using their faith to rid this space, or in the case of The Exorcist, a person, of a demonic entity. But even in The Exorcist, there was a team of people. Father Damien was the lead person, but there was a team of people supporting him at times. This is one other person who I will say this, when things were getting really rough for the guy who was using his faith to combat whatever this negative energy was, there were times when his teammate just up and left. It seems ridiculous. It seems completely ridiculous. So on the one hand, they vacillate back and forth between, again, team dynamics just off. There's one point where there's an acknowledgement that there might be something off and something's influencing this one investigator. And then in the next moment, the other investigator who recognizes that this person is being influenced leaves the person in the dust, chastises them. And then in the next scene, when they're supposed to be working together, leaves them completely in a panic. It seems too much. And again, this is supposed to be a seasoned person who has been a part of paranormal investigative teams. It seems silly. It seems for show. And it doesn't seem serious in that moment. So again, another reason why it's 3.5 and not lower, because entertainment value, because Connecticut and North Carolina were entertaining. Colorado, and I do believe it's Denver. The Denver conversation was hard to register or hard to get behind for a different reason. So this team, I genuinely felt, were scared at times. They definitely fought with each other. There was a lot of emotions running high. The other thing I think I need to remind you is that this show is primarily, when they're doing their work, it's late at night in the wee hours of the morning. And so they're using infrared or night vision, not infrared, but night vision. And so all the lights are off. And so they're doing this in the dark. And you can imagine that things are a little scary. And again, team dynamics, emotions run high. 28 days requires you to be on your P's and Q's and get along well with a group of people for that length of time. Again, who are all homesick, who are probably sleep deprived a little bit, hungry most of the time, and dealing with some spooky stuff. And so that team dynamic, I felt like that team was the most, they worked the best together, even though they had their challenges. But the story is the thing that got you. Of course, the show would not be complete without people feeling like they were being touched, hearing things banging and doors opening and closing and things like that. And so we certainly get that in all of the stories and all of the investigations. We get that. In the Denver one, this literally leads to not necessarily an answer, but to another story, uncovering someone's story that has never been told. They literally find an artifact that's been buried on the property, which probably is another reason for the 3.5, because what are the chances that a paranormal team is going to, over 28 days, with cameras rolling, uncover some of these, something that has up until this point been unknown completely? Like it would have been more realistic for the owners of the properties, because these are active properties. These are not abandoned properties that any of these teams went to. These are owned by folks and they're inhabited outside of these 28 days. They're inhabited by these people. Either people are living there or it's an active business. Like in the case of the Carolina shop, that's an active business. And so again, this show is really asking you to dispel a lot of belief or dispel a lot of unbelief to believe these people and the stories that they're telling. What they say about themselves is true and what they're experiencing is true. And that is hard to do, largely because of some of the things that happen just feel like they've been staged. But nevertheless, it's an interesting conversation, especially when you consider, if you just take a step back and open yourself up to the idea of exploring the ways that every culture talks about the spiritual world, the supernatural world, another plane of existence. Because even in Hinduism and Buddhism, the concept of nirvana is another plane of existence. I conflated that Nirvana is a Buddhist practice. I don't think it's not a Hindu practice, or a Hindu concept. But even in these very large non-Abrahamic religions, in Hinduism and Buddhism, I think Buddhism is probably practiced more widely than Hinduism, but nevertheless, there's always a reference to a higher plane of existence or another plane of existence. Whether or not it's higher remains to be seen. But another plane of existence, there's always an acknowledgement of that. And so if you are a practitioner of any of these faiths, the Abrahamic or Hindu and Buddhism, you don't think about things in black and white. You don't think of it as black and white. Because even though I talked about the Buhag or the Haint, there's a rationale for why they're in this space. The Jinn, there's a rationale. They have their own plane of existence. And so, yeah, I feel like these shows portray an ignorance of the ways in which the world, the different ways in which the world thinks about the supernatural, which has been watered down in most respects in the Western world to be paranormal. I don't know. And maybe I'm not doing paranormal science justice. It just feels like there needs to be, at least in these shows, they're done for shock value, but we're not even shocked anymore, as evidenced by the score. If you just went with the stories, like I chose to do, and I tried very hard to do, if these are true stories of these people's lives, that's heartbreaking and a really good reason for there to be some restlessness. But for them to manifest in the way that was described on TV is hard. That's a hard one to come to. But nevertheless, I would invite you to watch it yourself. It's interesting, and we're coming up, you know, Halloween, and I listen to a lot of different people who practice religion a little bit different than I do. And I listen to someone who is, I don't know if he calls himself a pastor. I don't know if he calls himself a rabbi, but he's definitely a personality on TikTok that teaches. I think he calls himself a pastor, but he's not a Christian. And he's not totally Jewish either. I don't think he describes to one form of the Abrahamic religions, but he does reference the religious text of both Judaism and Christianity as a means of making sense of, or at least to fuel his practice. And so I recognize that many people don't even acknowledge October, because they think it's, or not October, but October 31st, because if you know, you know that a lot of holidays in the Christian religion, we largely celebrate them because Constantine and other rulers who were Christian at the time wanted to convert a lot of folks. And in doing so, they did it by force. But you and I both know that you cannot force a person to walk through a particular spiritual faith. That is something that they have to walk into because it's so very personal. But nevertheless, they did it by force back then. And so a lot of the religion, or a lot of the holidays that we celebrate today, are really ways that the Christian church have tried to back in the dark ages, I guess, usurp other, basically it's just usurping other religions, festival days or high holidays, and absorb them in their own. Some of them, not all of them, but many of them, or some of them rather. And October 31st is one of them, or All Saints Day rather. All Saints Day, which is November 1st, was a way for the early Christian church, or at least the, maybe not early, but the middle Christian church, to kind of compromise and to convert more people by celebrating around celebrating the saints around the same time that many of these folks who practice other religions celebrated the harvest and other spiritual figures that the Roman Catholic Church at the time did not thought was blasphemous, or at least thought was idolatry. There's a whole nother conversation there that I'm not even getting into at the moment, but I guess what's my big point? It's important to acknowledge the ways in which other people practice their faith, especially as it means to give you some guidance on, or at least give you perspective, at least. Jiminy Christmas. Anyway, but because we're in a spooky season, people identify as a scary season. Other folks identify as an opportunity to celebrate their loved ones like they do in Mexico. Is that the 30th? Dia de los Muertos, I believe, is the 30th. And All Hallows Eve is the 31st. And then Hallows, All Saints Day, or Hallows Day, I guess, is the Greek term for saints. I can't remember. Dia de los Muertos. Oh, it's All Saints Day. It's the Catholic All Saints Day. Well, okay, never mind. Catholicism is a huge denomination of Christianity that's practiced in Mexico. So, duh, I don't know why I didn't put All Saints Day and Dia de los Muertos. Because it's Day of the Dead. But All Saints Day, the saints are deceased saints. Religious people who did mighty things. Okay. Anyway, but yeah, so because it's that time frame, it's a good time to listen. It's a good time to watch some of these things and form your own opinion and let it govern your own practices. But anyway, but yeah, that question still stands. How do people who practice Judaism, what's the relationship to the supernatural in Judaism? That's a question that I have for the community. So hopefully someone can who is a practitioner or is familiar. No, I want a practitioner, not someone who's familiar. I want someone who's it's a part of their life to speak to it. So please and thank you for refraining to answer the question if that's not a part of your practice. Again, I said I'm going to ask my my teammate in my religious cohort the same question. But it's just interesting to know because, again, Christianity and Islam speak to it in specific ways, which would make me think that so does Judaism. I just don't know enough to know where to look. So anyway, until next time, thank you, thank you, thank you. Appreciate you for listening. If you're not registered to vote, make sure that you do, especially in the United States. The UK, you have a new prime minister. I'll talk about that next week in the ways that I can. Very interesting. All the same, I've been following the news. I'll be watching. Anyway, but yeah, take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. Have fun with your family. Have some me time. Just take time for you, okay? And stay healthy. And till next time, thank you for listening. Please rate this show 4 or 5 stars. Share it with folks that you think might dig it, because that's ultimately going to help me continue to do this hobby that I do. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Until next time.